Associate Judges of the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces is now open and in session. God save the United States of America and this Honorable Court. Please be seated.
Good afternoon. Today, the base auditorium at Malmstrom Air Force Base has been transformed into a federal courthouse. We are grateful to Colonel Sandra Finnan, the commander of the 341st Space Wing, and Lieutenant Colonel Sean Sabin, the staff judge advocate, and their staffs for your thoughtful and careful planning in making this such a special outreach visit for the court. We welcome the men and women of the armed forces, members of the bar, and the public to these proceedings. We shall now proceed with oral argument in United States against Wilcox. I note for the record that Judge Margaret Ryan, who is not present, will participate in this case on the record. We shall hear first from counsel for the appellant.
Good afternoon. Private Wilcox was convicted of a crime for expressing his political views in private conversation on his own time to an apparently like-minded individual.
Can I ask you a question right off the bat about that? If you look at this about Charge 5 specification, what's on the table still after the CCA has gone through this twice, and you just indicated this case was about his private conversations with over the internet. Anything else?
Your Honor, all that stands of the specification is the charge that appellant wrongfully advocated anti-government and disloyal sentiments, and that he advocated racial intolerance by counseling and advising individuals on racist views. We don't know what category of speech Private Wilcox was convicted for.
Has he also been convicted of identifying himself as a U.S. Army paratrooper on his AOL profile while espousing racist viewpoints?
Exactly, Your Honor. That's part of the wrongfully advocating.
I guess what I'm trying to get at is this just about the email discussions with the agent, or is this also about how he projected himself on the internet?
To be perfectly honest, Your Honor, that's not clear. The Army Court relied most upon appellant's profiles. He had two AOL profiles. Another category of speech involved in this case is his private email conversations with Investigator Sturm. And finally, the third category of speech is an e-group posting that was alluded to by Investigator Sturm during
And that's
testimony.
With the anarchist group?
Correct, Your Honor.
And in your view, all three, he stands convicted of all three at this point, or all three form the basis for the conviction on the charge 5?
Yes, Your Honor.
Do we look at all three of those the same way?
No, and actually it would be useful for us to divide them into three distinct categories of speech and talk about each one in turn. And as I indicated earlier, the Army Court relied most upon the profiles. Appellant had two AOL profiles. The first was 11 lines long, and it identifies him as screen ID name W. Skullhead, has his location, birthday, gender, marital status, some hobbies, and then the personal quote, "We must secure the existence of our people and a future for our white children." The second profile is apparently a part of a dating service, vialove@aol.com, and it's very similar, lists his level of education, hobbies, and then there's a quote, which the government has cited in its brief, "I do not base my deeds on hate. Political affiliation is none. This government is not worth supporting in any of its component, in any of its components."
Could you repeat that last part again, please?
In its entirety, the quote says, "I am a pro-white activist doing what I can to promote the ideals of a healthier environment. I do not base my deeds on hate, but that of love for my folks, women, and children. Political affiliation is none. This government is not worth supporting in any of its components. Nature's and God's laws are eternal. Love your own kind and fight for your own kind. There's no hate in that."
And why is that not a disavowal of the United States government?
Well, under United States versus Harvey, Disagreement with or objection to a policy of the government is not indicative of disloyalty. And in Gray, this court held that a declaration of a personal belief can amount to a disloyal statement only if it disavows allegiance owed to the United States by the declarant.
Isn't that a pretty clear disavowal of allegiance?
Actually, Your Honor, it's...
This government is not worth defending?
Actually, Your Honor, it's quite ambiguous.
Please say how.
Well, we don't know if he's referring to our system of democracy, the current administration, Congress,
You're saying the word government is ambiguous.
The word government is ambiguous, and I think you would need a more express disavowal of allegiance to the United States to criminalize this speech. And the Vietnam era is replete with examples of soldiers making express disavowals of their allegiance. And that is what would be required to criminalize this speech in this case, Your Honor.
Why is it not service discrediting to hold yourself out as an Army paratrooper and a pro-white activist?
Well, Your Honor, you need to read the profiles as a whole. What you have, if you read the profiles as a whole, just as the general public would, you have an individual who says he believes in political discussions, expressly says he doesn't believe in hate, is very cautious not to be overtly racist, doesn't advocate racial intolerance, racial superiority, inferiority, or violence. And it is true, the quote from David Lane about white children may be a little cagey, but that's not the examination. The question has to be whether the profile as a whole is so patently offensive.
It's more than a little, I don't know what cagey means, but it's more than whatever that is.
This
is the classic hate statement, the 14 words. I mean, people know this as white supremacy stuff.
Well, but the examination has to be whether the profile as a whole is so patently offensive that it would expose the individual as a member of the armed forces or the armed forces in general to disrepute in the eyes of the public. And an invitation to engage in private conversation about politics and race, no matter how taboo those matters may be.
We're not to the conversation part yet, though. If he's out on the internet saying, this is who I am, this is my posting, I'm an Army paratrooper and I'm pro-white activist.
But if you look at that...
And here are 14 words you ought to take into account.
But if you look at that in context, Your Honor, this is nothing more than an invitation to engage in private conversation about those matters, a right that Private Wilcox certainly maintains under the First Amendment to the Constitution.
Counsel, in your response, are you conceding that those 14 words are words of racial exclusion and supremacy?
I don't think that they necessarily advocate racial intolerance by advising individuals on racist views as charged in the specification, and that gets into legal sufficiency. As I noted earlier, he's not advocating anything. He's expressing that he perhaps maintains this view, and by the very nature of this as a profile for Yahoo Instant Messenger, may be inviting others to discuss such matters with him, but it's not advocating at all, Your Honor.
You just mentioned that one of the questions here is whether or not this language was protected by the First Amendment. Are we talking about two different tests here? Are we talking about a test as to whether or not the speech was protected by the First Amendment? And then are we talking about a separate test as to whether or not the speech violates Article 134? Or, if we were to find that it violated 134, would it not be protected speech?
Well, in a nutshell, Your Honor, the scope of review in a free speech context is whether the speech presents a clear danger to loyalty, discipline, mission, or morale of the troops. The government has a legitimate interest in prescribing speech by service members because of the paramount importance of the military mandate. That's where it derives its legitimate interest in prescribing speech at all. So there has to be some link, some danger that the speech presents to good order and discipline in the military.
Well, hang on. Is it good order and discipline alone or discredited or good order and discipline?
Well, there's two separate clauses and both were charged in this case.
Why can't it not merely be discrediting?
Well, I would note that no court of military appeals has ever affirmed in a military free speech case under Clause 2 of Article 134. And this is likely because only unpopular beliefs or opinions could be service discrediting. And permitting the government to criminalize unpopular speech in this manner will be the very evil sought to be protected against by the framers when they enacted the First Amendment. Aside from that, the government has, as the Supreme Court has held in Parker versus Levy, a legitimate interest in good order and discipline in the armed forces. No court, including the Supreme Court, has ever held that the military has a legitimate interest that extends to its reputation. But more directly in response to whether or not...
The government doesn't have an interest in the military's reputation?
It may have an interest, but in terms when you're of balancing
recruiting,
that...
This is the 82nd Airborne. They are the force that went into Little Rock, for example. The military doesn't have a stake in having that force being seen as racially neutral and career professional?
Well, Your Honor, I was merely noting as a threshold point that no court has affirmed under Clause 2 because of the inherent dangers in that...
Because of the inherent dangers or because GOND was available?
Well, it could be that. But if we want to address service, you know, the actual state speech of appellant and whether or not it's service discrediting on its face, it's important to note that, again, if you read these profiles as a whole, they're not patently offensive. They're merely an invitation to discuss race and politics. And the prospect of any damage to the military's reputation is far too remote. Based on these 11-line profile out there in cyberspace along with everything else. And there's actually no evidence in this case that there was any damage to the reputation of the armed forces, nor any impact on good order and discipline.
Could you move on to the emailing and messaging to get off the profile?
Yes, Your Honor. When evaluating whether the appellant's speech presents a clear danger to good order and discipline in the military, you have to look at the when, the where, and the how of the speech. The time, the place, and the circumstances are important. These internet conversations with Investigator Sturm are direct one-on-one typed conversations between two individuals. It's like a telephone conversation, as Investigator Sturm characterized it. They're private.
Is it permissible for a military member to make racist statements in a private conversation, in your view?
It can only be prescribed if there is some impact on good order and discipline. There has to be some palatable and direct potential impact on good order and discipline.
And you just can't get there from here for discredit. As long as you're within the First Amendment, shouting distance of the First Amendment, you can discredit the military all you want.
Well, as far as the private conversations with Investigator Sturm, private conversations between two individuals could never be service discrediting.
Well, I'm still looking at the profiles as well. I know Judge Erdman wants you to get off the profiles, but
the profiles in and of themselves are just not patently offensive, and I think it's useful to look.
So in theory, it could be discrediting. You're saying these emails aren't? Or are you saying
these emails could never be because they're private conversations?
As a matter of law, you could never get there.
Never get there because they're private conversations.
So then, counsel, is your argument that, and I know you're not going to put it this way, but that if these emails had been placed, the text of these emails had been placed on his AOL website, we would be in a different position then. That is, the text of these emails at that point could be in a service discrediting context because they are published in a public forum.
I think you'd certainly be a lot closer to the line, Your Honor. I think it's important to note that in all the military free speech cases and the Priest line of cases, as distinguished from this case, the appellants in those cases targeted service members. I mean, this was public speech. They were speaking as soldiers, expressly seeking a breakdown of good order and discipline, advocating an immediate and direct disobedience by members of the armed forces. Appellant speech in this case is merely private conversation, in the most part, and communications with Investigator Sturm on his own time at the end of the day. And he has every right under the First Amendment to engage in this speech unless there's some clear danger to good order and discipline in the armed forces.
What about his posting on the anarchist website? I mean, that the intended audience there is, would be the public, I would imagine.
Well, the intended audience was the readership of the National Anarchist people. But first, it's important to note that the actual posting isn't evidence in this case. Prosecution Exhibit 13 for identification was never admitted. The Army Court did not rely upon this posting. And this isn't a disavowal of allegiance to the United States.
Wait a minute now. So you're saying the posting on the anarchist website is not in play here?
Well, it's not in play for service discrediting, Your Honor, because
you said it was in play at the outset. when I asked you what was on the table.
It's a category of speech, but as far as being prosecuted or criminalized under Clause 2, we don't get there because he doesn't, according to Investigator Sturm on page 212, identify himself as a member of the Army. He could be some Mr. Smith out there expressing his views about the military, and without some link to the military or his status as a soldier, he could be not held to be.
But isn't he using his profile name, the W. Skullhead? Or is he? I don't know.
That's not clear. Investigator Sturm alluded to this e-group posting. I merely included it as a category of speech because it could be fairly said to be on the table. But her description is pretty weak.
Counsel, can you identify in the record precisely how this anarchist website information came into evidence, and is it or is it not evidence with respect to either prejudice to good order, discipline, or service of discrediting? That is, the posting on the anarchist website was not admitted into evidence by the judge.
No, it wasn't.
Agent Sturm testified as to what she saw on that at that point.
Yes,
what purpose does it serve in evidence in this case, and how can we determine for what purpose it was introduced into evidence?
I'm not sure what purpose the government introduced this evidence for. It could be to slander his, I don't know, Your Honor.
Was there an objection?
Not to that, Your Honor. There have been objections to some other e-group postings.
Was there an objection to the introduction of that testimony regarding the fact of the post?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
What about page 165? This goes to the issue of whether he's holding himself out in his military status out in the e-group stuff. The question is, okay, now does he talk at all? Is there any reference to some military status at any point in that email message? And then down on line 13, I wouldn't want it to be known that you are attending some pro-white festival concert with an Army guy. It just wouldn't sound cool.
That's a very important point, Your Honor, because if you read the record and the totality of the evidence in this case, it demonstrates that Private Wilcox went to great lengths to keep his privately held political beliefs separate from his military career. He once counseled Investigator Sturm, don't talk to people about your associates at work, about your beliefs, because it could just cause problems, yours or mine, with our colleagues.
So you think that actually cuts in favor of your...
That cuts in favor because...
Non-military status.
He actually sought to prevent there being a nexus between his speech and... good order and discipline in the military, and as Staff Sergeant Shook and PFC Rios' testimony explains, that there was no racial discord, there's no racial slurs by Private Wilcox. He treated everybody of all race and heritage the same, that he was, by all accounts, a good soldier.
So basically what he was is a philosophical anarchist on the Proudhon model?
Well, I think he was a guy with some extreme and abnormal, maybe eccentric views, but he has every right to have those under the First Amendment, so long as they do not impact good order and discipline. That is the government's legitimate interest.
So the government has to wait till there's actual impact, so he can be, I'm going to not take this from the record, but he can be yapping up with the anarchists and talking about the duties of a lone wolf, but until the lone wolf acts, the government can't step in because there's no palpable effect on good order and discipline.
Your Honor, I see that I'm out of time.
You can answer that question, and I'm going to have a follow-up.
Government's in a hard spot there. They have to wait for the rider truck to show up before they can take action?
No, Your Honor. The government doesn't have to wait to be injured. It has an interest in preventing injury, but there has to at least be a clear danger. And where speech is perhaps, like in the police line of cases, targeted.
And there's no danger
members.
Talking lone wolf stuff with the group called Anarchist?
Well, lone, he's...
And I'm mixing...
Appellant expressly sought to avoid association with organizations and affiliations with organizations.
That's why I mentioned lone wolf.
That was this.
And lone wolf is just as dangerous in that regard. Why doesn't the government have it? Isn't there a danger with respect to the lone wolf?
Maybe there's a remote or indirect, but what is required is direct and palpable danger. And perhaps as he starts making preparations to engage in some act of violence, well, then you have a conspiracy, which is an actual criminal offense. The question is whether the government's legitimate interest in good order and discipline and protecting itself outweighs the First Amendment. And we don't cross that line until there's some clear danger, some clear threat.
In the abstract, as a matter of theory, not necessarily fact here, can incitement qualify? Or is it your argument that there has to be some action?
Incitement of an immediate lawless action, but not philosophical discussions at the end of the day about politics and race, such as we have in this case.
Counsel, my question, Bob, to that is an analogy to the legislation that prohibits persons from being members of the armed forces if they make a statement, a declaration of homosexuality. Now, there's no requirement in there that the person do anything other than make that statement, and they can be eliminated from the armed forces. And every court that has reviewed that has said that that is sufficient, and they've rejected First Amendment challenges on those grounds. So why would it be any different for a person who says, I'm a homosexual, to not have the First Amendment right to say that in the armed forces, whereas you're suggesting someone has the right to say, I am a white racist?
It's a question of context, Your Honor. If somebody declares that they're homosexual and it becomes known to their unit, obviously there's a pretty good potential for adverse effects on good order and discipline.
I understand the statute. There's no requirement that it becomes known to the unit. If it becomes known to anyone in authority in the armed forces, that's sufficient.
And perhaps if somebody in an appellant's unit knew that he was a racist or held these beliefs in private, this would be a different case. Thank you.
Thank you. You have an opportunity on rebuttal. Counsel for the government.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. My name is Captain Michael Pond, and along with Colonel John Miller, I represent the United States in this matter. Appellant advocated the murder of minorities and the violent overthrow of the U.S. government in a public forum while clothing himself in the mantle of the United States Army.
Okay, counsel, what words did he say that advocated murder of minorities in a public forum? If we put aside his emails, which do not appear to be in a public forum, and the question of the anarchist posting, in which there's some issue as to whether that comes into trial. But let's just take the two AOL postings. Where did he advocate the murder of anyone in the two AOL postings?
Well, Your Honor, when we made that statement in opening, we were not relying upon the AOL postings.
Okay, what in the AOL postings, if anything, falls within the prohibitions of Article 134?
The statement where appellant stated that the United States government was not worth supporting in any of its components could be read as a statement disavowing loyalty to the government. And it's important to recall, in the context of Judge Erdman's question before, that in its legal sufficiency review, this court draws all inferences in favor of the prosecution. So whether appellant intended that as referring to a local government, state government, U.S. government, in the context of this court's legal sufficiency review, the question is, could a rational trier of fact have concluded that referred to the government?
Are we in a pure legal sufficiency review when there is a First Amendment issue that's involved? And I refer specifically to this court's test as expounded in United States against Priest, the Vietnam era case, in which the court said we needed to balance the danger discounted by the likelihood of anyone viewing that as likely to cause a particular action. So don't we have to take the First Amendment test into account when reviewing legal sufficiency?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Okay, so how would you apply the Priest test to those particular words, which you noted could be read as disavowing allegiance, but not necessarily so?
Well, again, the Priest test is whether the constitutional test is whether appellant statements present a clear danger to the mission, morale, discipline. And in the context of statements, we would ask this court to look at the content of the statements as well as the form in which they are made and the fact that appellant held himself out as a soldier while making these statements. All three of those facts interconnect to create the clear danger which allows the government to prescribe those statements.
And the danger is what?
There are actually two dangers in this case, but the main danger is that a soldier who reads what appellant wrote and who knew that he, appellant, was a soldier, especially if that soldier were himself a Jew or of a mixed race couple.
Let's just talk about the AOL profile right now.
Okay, Your Honor.
That was my question, focusing on the AOL profile. And then after you've answered that, then we can address the others.
Well, I think the AOL profile is useful in terms of establishing the sufficiency of his conviction under 134, mainly with regard to the anti-government.
I still want my question answered, though. What's the danger if we're just talking about the profile?
Well, the danger would be that soldiers who saw that a paratrooper did not believe that the government was worth supporting in any of its components, their morale would be affected. But I think the larger danger would be...
Is that a clear and present danger? In your view, must it be a clear and present danger?
It needs to be a clear danger, okay. Your Honor. The risk represented by that danger need not have manifested itself. But again, there must be a clear danger to morale or, again, the mission of the Army. And I think that's where your questions to counsel regarding the service discrediting element come into play, because the constitutional test is not limited to a clear danger to morale or discipline. It's also to the mission. And for the Army to execute its mission, to some extent at least, it requires the support of the public. And if the public sees what appellant wrote, then that support...
If he had not identified himself as a paratrooper or a member of the Army, had said the same thing, and the CID had ferreted out the fact that he was a member of the Army, would this violate Article 134?
It's a much closer case, Your Honor. I think the fact that he identified himself is important in the following sense. Let's assume for the moment that a soldier did see what he wrote, but appellant didn't identify himself as a soldier. That soldier who read that might conclude that appellant was deranged, it might conclude that appellant was misguided or a bad guy, but it would have no bearing on his unit cohesion, his morale as a soldier, because he wouldn't know that it was another soldier who had said it. And that's why the fact that appellant identified himself as a soldier is important in this case, because that's what keys or alerts soldiers who view this to the fact that this is a fellow paratrooper who's making these statements. You've got a paratrooper, paratroopers who are themselves Jewish of mixed race or immigrants or sons of immigrants, and you have an appellant here who, and again, this is the record at 144, is celebrating the murder of a Jewish talk show host, characterizing that as what a group of concerned citizens did and not just talked about.
How would people know who were looking at that it was an Army paratrooper? Did he identify himself in that particular posting as an Army paratrooper?
Well, these are the conversations that he had with Investigator Stern.
Okay.
So those conversations are replete with self-identifications.
Okay. Can I ask just a quick framework question? Yeah, yeah. Do you agree with the factual paradigm that the appellant put on the table that we're dealing with three different issues here? Factual issues, profiles, conversations with Storm, and the e-group stuff? Did you break it down the same way, or are we off on our tangent?
The way I would look at it, Your Honor, is looking at the evidence as a whole and then feeding that into the good order and discipline, that third element of 134 and the constitutional test. Appellant has a point to in the following sense. What he posted on the public internet bulletin board, that's an easier case for the government, because that required only a username and a password.
I think I was asking you a simpler question.
Okay.
Are those the three factual patterns we're looking at, or is there something else we should be looking at as well? Or are you taking any of those off the table and saying, no, the government's case is based on this?
We're looking at the record as a whole, Your Honor. So we're not looking at anything
other. This is your opportunity. So when we're back having our conference and we're going to focus on the three critical facts, you'd like us to focus on the record as a whole?
We would like you to
identify those three things for us?
No, Your Honor. Okay. What we'd like you to focus on is the content of the statements, the form in which they're made, and the fact that he identified himself as a paratrooper, because it's those three things taken together which create the danger that exists in this case.
Well, how can a private conversation with an individual on the internet impact good order and discipline?
Well, as this court stated in Hartwig, Your Honor, the fact that a conversation is intended to be private does not cloak it in First Amendment protection. when a person has a conversation with another individual whom he knows, for example, if appellant had this made these exact same statements to his brother or his father, the danger that we're looking at in this case is absent. But when he's making those statements on the internet to someone he doesn't know, it's not that other soldiers could be listening in on this chat. We'll accept the fact, for the sake of argument, that this was a one-on-one conversation, but the point is, it was a conversation with someone he didn't know, and that person could have been a soldier. And the Army doesn't have to sit back and wait as he continues to make these proselytize to these people.
So under the first...
I asked whether that was a direct and palpable impact, if it could have been a soldier. I mean, that seems a little bit remote. That means in a little bit of a... one or two steps away.
Well, the point is, Your Honor, that the Army doesn't have to, or the command in this case, does not have to sit back and wait until and try to source each person that he's talking to until he finally hits a soldier.
So that mere potential out there in the universe of the internet is sufficient.
Given the murderous nature of his statements and the fact that he's identifying himself as a paratrooper, in a sense, appellant is assuming the risk when he goes out there that these people who he doesn't know could be soldiers.
So you're equating everything from the AOL profile that identifies himself as a U.S. Army paratrooper and then carrying that over to the private conversations and to the postings on the anarchist website. Because without that, you don't have a U.S. Army connection there.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Okay. The only place that I understand that publicly he announces that he is a U.S. Army paratrooper is on the AOL profile. Is that correct?
He also announced he was a U.S. Army paratrooper in one of the E-group postings that he made, which Investigator Sturm alluded to at the record at 212. He said, as an Army paratrooper, we learn by field manuals, and here's a copy of the Army's operations manual to better assist you in combating the United States Army. So it's not the case that someone would have to trace back, although it would have been fairly easy to do so. W. Skullhead, all they'd have to do, as Investigator Sturm testified, would be to establish an AOL account and just look him up. So it would have been fairly, number one, it would have been fairly easy to trace him back, but separate and apart from that, he did announce himself to be a paratrooper on the public internet bulletin board, which anyone could read.
Does he have, therefore, a duty to inquire in private emails as the identity of the recipient with what is otherwise at least arguably constitutionally protected speech?
Well, we would distinguish an email because when you compose...
I'm talking about the emails. You're saying that he's throwing them out there and he's assuming the risk that they will go to the wrong person, i.e. another member of the United States Army. Does he therefore have some sort of positive duty to inquire as to the identity before he can engage in constitutionally protected speech?
Well, we would distinguish, this is not a case where someone sent an email intending it to be for person X and it inadvertently went to person Y. He was broadcasting using his profile.
No, I'm not talking about the profile. I'm talking about the email conversation, because you're trying to bring this, you're saying that whenever you, even the emails, whenever you put this out on the internet, or I understood you to say, that whenever you put this out on the internet, even in the context of an email conversation, it could get into the wrong hands. Or maybe I misunderstood what you were saying.
Well, it's not that it could get into the wrong hands, and maybe this is a distinction without a difference, but we're talking about chats rather than emails. And usually when you send an email, you know who you're sending an email to.
Mm-hmm.
A chat, basically, he's talking to someone he doesn't know. So
he's in the process of trying to develop a relationship with this person, is he not?
He was, Your Honor.
No question about it. Isn't that her testimony in here as well, that's what was going on here? Not from her perspective, of course. She's an undercover agent. But she is portraying herself as someone who's interested in a relationship with him.
She was, Your Honor. But okay. Again...
And so now we have an individual. Why is this any different from an airman who, after a bad day at Malmstrom Air Force Base, goes into a bar, meets somebody, and starts talking to them, and he has a conversation of this nature? Would that be the same case or a different case?
It would depend on the facts, but if an airman walked into a bar and in uniform, and we're drawing an analogy between actually wearing the uniform and holding yourself out as a paratrooper. I don't think there's much difference there. But if you walked into a bar and struck up a conversation with another person who he did not know and started stating to that person that he wanted minorities dead and their corpses...
No, what if he just said, the Air Force sucks. I hate the Air Force. You know what happened to me today? Blah, 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 blah. In other words, grousing in a bar. Leave the race out of it.
Sure, and that would be a different case because soldiers grouse all the time.
Soldiers grouse all the time.
So what's the difference about two lance corporals in a foxhole having the same conversation?
Because if the lance corporal in a foxhole is stating that he believes that immigrants and mixed race soldiers or individuals, ostensibly to include soldiers and their families, and Jewish individuals should be killed, that is qualitatively different than an argument over immigration policy or something else. That's
well, how do you distinguish, what guidance do you give two lance corporals in a foxhole who gripe? What First Amendment, if Harry Calvin talked about the essential balance between finding that zone of protected speech and finding that zone of speech that goes too far, and that was a very hard art. What guidance would you advise this court, perhaps, to give the two lance corporals in the foxhole?
Well,
do they have no speech protection in that foxhole?
Certainly they do, Your Honor.
Okay, so how far does it extend?
Don't advocate the murder of individuals of an ethnic group that are present in the Army. Because that, if heard by those kinds of soldiers,
where is that present in the three fact patterns? Is that present in the profiles?
Not directly.
Is that present in the E group?
Yes. The United States Army is your biggest enemy.
That's advocating murder?
Well.
Or is that a distasteful political view or gripe or hate speech of some sort?
That goes more to the anti-government aspect of it because he's supplying the anarchists who are listening with the Army's operations manual to allow them to more effectively. But to go to the third point, it is present in his chats.
Is the Army operation manual classified or is it a public document?
Oh, it's a public document, Your Honor. That's something he could certainly argue in mitigation, that this was something that was already available. But that doesn't bear directly on the question of the danger that he's creating because it's actually worse when you think about it. It's worse than priests because in Priest of the Army talked or this court talked about, there's no evidence that, or I think this was Gray, that he was reaching an audience that was already disposed to insubordination. Well, he's clearly reached that audience in this case. And he's going onto a National Anarchist website and supplying the Army's operations manual to a self-selected group of individuals who tend to agree with his proposition that the United States Army
I'll get off it in a second, but still the two guys in the foxhole, all you've told them so far is they can't advocate killing anybody other than the enemy. Any other guidance to give them? Otherwise, it's fine. Is that what I hear you saying?
No, I mean, we're using the facts.
The First Amendment cone has come down on top of them?
No, we're using the facts that are present in this case, Your Honor. I mean, this court, as this court stated in Priest,
could they have a conversation about David Lane and whether his views were well-founded or not?
Arguably, they could. But again, the context is very important. If you're talking to somebody who you know and you're having a conversation about policy, that's one thing. But if you're advocating murder, that's quite different.
Murder and strangers. Okay. No, I just wanted to make sure. Murder and strangers.
As I read the opinion from the Court of Criminal Appeals, I did not see them identify the appellant as advocating murder. Is there a place in the Court of Criminal Appeals decision where that court found that he had advocated murder?
Not directly, Your Honor. We were just looking at the record
Because it appears from what they're relying on are statements that he made of an apocalyptic nature. And it's not apparent from the references in the court's decision below that they have found that he advocated anything as opposed to describing a vision of what he believed might happen in the world.
Well, again, I think this goes, and I know which quote you're citing there, Your Honor, but I think this goes back to this court drawing inferences in favor of the prosecution. He's saying blood will flow, lying Judeo, I'm sure I'm not getting this right, but congressmen will have to pay for their crimes.
Retribution will be ours.
Retribution will be ours. That could certainly be read as wanting those things to happen.
Is this shouting fire in a crowded theater?
Well, as you know, Your Honor, the Brandenburg test is, the incitement test is not applicable in the military.
I'm not talking about Brandenburg, I'm talking about Schenck.
Yes, Your Honor. Is this shouting fire in a crowded theater?
Does this present an immediate, palpable danger to good order and discipline? And if so, how?
It presents a clear danger. Now, it
clear
does
and present.
Well, this court's most recent articulation of that standard doesn't include the word present. And that may be to emphasize that the standard in the military is a lower standard than Brandenburg, not requiring an intent to incite or an immediate threat. A danger can exist, even though it has not manifested itself. In this case, that danger was the product of what he said, the form in which he said it, and the fact that he represented himself as a soldier. Now, you can alter those variables in such a way that his speech ends up protected. For example, if he did not identify himself as a soldier, how are other soldiers who hear his speech supposed to know, how is that going to affect their good order and discipline? Arguably, it does not. It's certainly service discrediting if they and creates the danger if they know he's a soldier. Similarly, you could change the forum, and if he's having this, making these exact same statements to his dad or his brother, they would be protected because, again, there's no nexus between what he's saying and a danger to good order and discipline. But it's these three factors when combined, they interlock together to create that danger. And that is the danger that existed in this case.
Counsel, though your time has expired, are there any other questions from colleagues? If you'd like to make a concluding statement, please do so.
Thank you. Members of the court, appellant was not punished for holding unpopular views. The government is not asserting that he cannot hold those views. The government is not even asserting that he cannot share those views on the internet. What the government is asserting is that he cannot do so while clothing himself in the mantle of the uniform. When appellant did so, he created a clear danger to the morale and the unit cohesion of any soldier who viewed his comments and knew that one of their comrades wanted him, and by extension his family, dead. Appellant's conviction was based on legally sufficient evidence and does not run afoul of the First Amendment and should be affirmed by this honorable court. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Briefly, Your Honor. Contrary to the government's argument, Private Wilcox was punished for his views. The only reason we're here today is because Private Wilcox chose to comment on matters that touch the heart of our prevailing notions of racial equality and tolerance. We're only testing the substance of his protections under the First Amendment because he chose to comment on something that matters much. We must ask ourselves, absent any real harm, isn't PFC Wilcox's freedom to express his eccentric and abnormal views a small price to pay for the right of service members as individual citizens to have free minds?
Counselor, can a military member bring discredit upon the military in a one-on-one conversation?
No, Your Honor.
And why can't he do that if that individual is a member of the public?
Well, because that conversation is...
We're not talking about prejudicial to good order and discipline. We're talking about bringing discredit on the armed forces. So why can't an individual in the military making a statement to another individual, a member of the public, why can't that bring discredit to the armed forces if in fact the statement falls into that category.
Well, I think there's really two prongs to the service discrediting test. One would be that the remarks are patently offensive. The second would be that the remarks were uttered under such circumstances as to expose that person or the military in general to disrepute in the eyes of the public. And okay, if the circumstances are conversation with a like-minded individual, you just don't get there, Your Honor.
So what constitutes a member, what constitutes the public? It has to be more than one, two, five? I mean, why can't it be one?
Well, it's just a relevant circumstance, part of the when, the where, and the how of the speech. A relevant circumstance in this case is that Investigator Stern posed as a like-minded individual. And at some point, Private Wilcox is entitled to rely upon her representations of who she is. She was the first one to utter racial remarks. She brought it up. He was very cautious and guarded in his beliefs and didn't freely discuss those with her until she identified herself of like mind. And certainly he is entitled to do that under the First Amendment.
Counsel, I'm not sure you're answering the question. The question is whether, as a matter of law, service discrediting conduct can take place in a one-on-one conversation. You're explaining why, in your view, it didn't take place in this case. Are you asking us to hold that it can never take place in a one-on-one?
No, Your Honor. It could take place in a one-on-one conversation. And the distinguishing factor, and if you look to Hartwig, Guerrero, Choate, and Saunders for guidance, in all those cases where you did have service discrediting conduct, the audience was an unwilling audience. And that was the point I was trying to make, is that Investigator Stern was not an unwilling audience.
With respect to the profiles, is your argument based on the view that those are not patently offensive?
They're not patently offensive.
That's the crux of your argument?
There's really two prongs to my argument. A, if they're not patently offensive, and B, if Private Wilcox has a First Amendment right to engage in private conversation about politics and race, that right must at the very least extend to an invitation to engage in such conversation. Okay. In the profiles.
One more question. Our case law has bounced around a bit. If you were to pick one case that you hope we build our analysis around, which case would that be?
United States versus Brown.
Judge Stuckey, I believe you had a question?
I'll pass.
Okay. Thank you very much for your argument, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And we thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today. The case is now submitted, and at a future conference, the judges will take it under advisement. At this point, we've concluded the formal proceedings. The clerk will adjourn the court. Once we are adjourned, the judges will remain in place for a question and answer session. And so I will now turn to the clerk of court.
All rise. The court stands adjourned until further order of the court. Please be seated.